Trigger warning. This podcast may include explicit content that will take you out of your comfort zone and make you question reality. Listener's discretion is advised.
Hello! What is going on, everybody? Can you believe we are back? I almost can't believe we're back, but here we are touring the canyon once more. With everything that's been going on in my life, I couldn't help but to immerse myself into the one thing that I'm most passionate about. To reinvigorate my researching skills and to bring the fire once more to this very important topic. So, if you would be so kind to indulge me yet again, I want to take you on another tour of some of Laurel Canyon's strangest characters. Are you ready? Are you ready? All right, here we go. Starting with one of Laurel Canyon's earliest and brightest stars, Mr. Stephen Stills. Everyone buckled up? Let's begin. So, Stephen Stills has the distinction of being a founding member of two of Laurel Canyon's most acclaimed and beloved bands, Buffalo Springfield, and of course, Crosby, Stills, and Nash. In addition, Stills will write perhaps the first and certainly one of the most enduring anthems of the 60s generation, For What It's Worth. Let's hear a little bit from Mr. Stills right now.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
You know, that is still one of my favorite songs, which is why I was so interested in this topic, because I grew up idolizing these people. I get it, this stuff is really hard to research, but everyone needs to know. Anyways. Stills will follow up For What It's Worth with a single entitled Bluebird, which stuck out to me right away, because coincidentally or not, Bluebird happens to be the original code name assigned to the MK Ultra program. And we're going to get into this in a little more detail. Hang on. Before his arrival in Laurel Canyon, Stephen Stills was, the product of yet another career military family. Now, raised partly in Texas, young Stephen spent large chunks of time in El Salvador, Costa Rica, the Panama Canal Zone, and various other parts of Central America, alongside his father, who was, we can be fairly certain, helping to spread democracy to the unwashed masses in that endearingly American way. As with the rest of our cast of characters, Stills was educated primarily at schools on military bases and at elite military academies. So, maybe that's why he knows a little something about the original name for the MKUltra program. But there is, however, an even more curious aspect to the Stephen Stills story. Stephen will later tell anyone who will sit and listen that he had served time for Uncle Sam in the jungles of Vietnam. These tales will be universally dismissed by chroniclers of the era as nothing more than drug-induced delusions. Such a thing couldn't possibly be true, right? Since Stephen arrived on the Laurel Canyon scene at the very time that the first uniformed troops began shipping out, and he remained in the public eye thereafter. So how could it be that Stephen served time for Uncle Sam in the jungles of Vietnam? But what is ignored is the undeniable fact that the U.S. had thousands of what they call quote-unquote advisors, which is to say CIA special forces operatives operating in the country for a good many years before the arrival of the first official ground troops. What will also be ignored is that given his background, his age, and the timeline of events, Stephen Stills not only could indeed have seen action in Vietnam, he would seem to have been a prime candidate for such an assignment. After which, of course, he could rather quickly become, stop me if you've heard this one before, an icon of the peace generation. A reassignment, if you will. And while we're on this, let's not forget Stills' buddy, David Crosby, who is much more than just the son of Major Floyd Delafield Crosby. This is going to be slightly a recap, but it's definitely worth going over again. So David Van Cortlandt Crosby, as we touched on before, is a scion of the closely intertwined Van Cortlandt, Van Schuyler, and Van Rieslinger. Rieslinger? I can't even pronounce it. It looks like some French shit. Van Rieslinger families. So I get it. You're probably thinking the Van Who families. Well, let me tell you. I can assure you that if you plug one of those names into Wikipedia or Google whatever, DuckDuckGo, you can spend a pretty fair amount of time reading up on the power wielded by this clan for the last, 2¼ centuries or so. Yeah, that's right. Suffice it to say that the Crosby family tree, as a recap, includes that truly dizzying array of U.S. senators and congressmen, state senators and assemblymen, governors, mayors, judges, Supreme Court justices, Revolutionary and Civil War generals, signers of the Declaration of Independence, and members of the Continental Congress. It also includes more than a few high-ranking Masons. So Stephen Van Rieslinger III, for example, reportedly served as Grand Master of Masons for New York. And if all that isn't impressive enough, according to the New England Genealogical Society, David Van Cortlandt Crosby is also a direct descendant of the Founding Fathers and Federalist Papers author Alexander Hamilton and John Jay. And he somehow becomes a anti-war, fuck the man, peace and love. We all know what he became, but when your family is this, how do you become that? And while we're at it, someone else that we're going to be looking at here on the tour is Graham Parsons, who would briefly replace David Crosby in the Byrds before he went on to front the Flying Burrito Brothers. So Graham was the son of Major Cecil Ingram, quote unquote, Coondog Connor II, a decorated military officer and bomber pilot who reportedly flew over 50 combat missions. Parsons was also an heir on his mother's side to the formidable Snively family fortune. And what a name, by the way. The Snively family is said to be the wealthiest family in the inclusive enclave of Winter Haven, Florida. And the Snivelys were the proud owners of Snively Groves Incorporated, which reportedly owned as much as one-third of all the citrus groves in the state of Florida. They've probably partnered with Bill Gates for your favorite hippie orange juice. But that's besides the point. We've now covered Stephen Stills in a little bit more detail, touched on David Crosby again, looked at Graham Parsons, but we're not done. So moving on to a couple of new turds, let's look at a trio of Laurel Canyon vocalists who rose to dizzying heights of fame and fortune that we haven't discussed before. Gary Beckley, Dan Peek, and Dewey Bunnell. Or Bunnell? I don't know. I just know these shits as America. Now, individually, these three names are probably unknown to virtually all of you as they were to me. But collectively, they were the band America. And these three will score huge hits in the early 70s with songs like Ventura Highway, A Horse with No Name, and the Wizard of Oz-themed song The Tin Man, which I will touch on more here in just a minute. But I guess I probably don't need to add here that all three of these lads were products of the military intelligence community. Beckley's dad was the commander of the now defunct Wes Rislip United States Air Force Base near London, England, a facility deeply immersed in intelligence operations, among other things. But just like Stephen Stills, writing a song with a nod in the direction of the OG MK Ultra, America has a song with a nod to The Wizard of Oz, which is what? MK Ultra. I already told you Wizard of Oz was MK Ultra as a motherfucker, but I would encourage you to go back to listen to that episode if you have not, even though it's old and, you know, it didn't come out within the last few weeks. It's one of those timeless episodes that I always recommend going back to. Now, what about Dewey and Dan? Well, their fathers were both career Air Force officers serving under Beckley's dad at Wes Rislip, which is where these three boys had their fateful meeting. Think about that. So they didn't come together in the canyon. That's what I keep harping on. They didn't magically find each other, just like with the mamas and the papas. They didn't discover friendship and love of music and their disdain for the US government while passing a fucking blunt around. No. Even with America, Dan and Dewey's dad worked for Gary's dad at this fucking Air Force base in London, England, which was deeply immersed in intelligence operations, amongst other things. And then they were all like hanging out, and they were all like, we have sons. And they all met up at the fucking Air Force base, grew up together, moved to the US, started this band, and they have like little hints here and there in their songs, let's just say, with the Tin Man, among other things. Now, let's take a look at this. All these folks gathered nearly simultaneously along the narrow, winding roads of Laurel Canyon. How could this be? I mean, they came from across the country, specifically from the Washington, D.C. area, which was particularly represented in LC, as well as from Canada and England. And magically, they all got the memo to start gathering up in Laurel Canyon. They came even though at the time, there wasn't much of a pop music industry in Los Angeles. They came even though at the time, there was no live pop music scene to speak of. They came even though there was no discernible reason for them to do so. It would make sense nowadays for an inspiring musician to venture out to Los Angeles. Nowadays. But in those days, the centers of the music universe were in Nashville, Detroit, New York. It wasn't the industry that drew the Laurel Canyon crowd, but rather the Laurel Canyon crowd that transformed Los Angeles into the epicenter of the music industry is continuing to draw folks out there. And to what then do we attribute this unprecedented gathering of future musical superstars in the hills above Los Angeles? What was it that inspired them to all head out west? Perhaps Neil Young said it best when he told an interviewer that he couldn't really say why he headed out to Los Angeles circa 1966. He and others, quote, were just going, end quote. You know, there's a lot of things that I don't understand, okay? In this world, sure, there are a lot of things that I just don't understand. Like, why don't Cheez-Its taste anything like cheese and more like scorned crackers or something? But all of the commercials for Cheez-Its talk about how cheesy they are. And I've never eaten a drier motherfucking cracker in my life. But this I finally am beginning to understand after all these installments of LC. I believe that the reason there's so much demonic energy that encompasses LA, Laurel Canyon, California, is to do with not only the name California, which goes back to like the goddess Cali and all this stuff and blood drinking, but these were more than just musicians and singers and songwriters who had come together in Laurel Canyon. They were destined to become the spokesmen and the de facto leaders of a generation of disaffected youth. The unprecedented mass appeal of the new rock and roll gave these singers a voice in public affairs, and that is why they were sent there. And that, of course, is why, to an overwhelming degree, the sons and daughters of the military intelligence complex and the scions of families that have wielded vast wealth and power in this country for centuries wound up in Laurel Canyon. Oh yeah, we're just getting to the good part. Head on over to the Cosmic Peach Patreon and make your reservation to room 237 to enjoy the rest of this episode. Not sure how to get there? Simply scroll down to the description of this episode and click the link. Or go to patreon.com/cosmicpeachpodcast. There is also a Patreon app if you're interested. What's in room 237? Well, thanks for asking, Danny. But a great caretaker never reveals their secrets. See for yourself and uncover bonus content, extended versions of episodes, Patreon exclusive 10% off code for all merch, early access to every single episode, sneak peeks or behind the scenes content, and whatever else I'm in the mood for. There are plenty of amenities to enjoy while you are checked in to room 237. Take a trip up the Sidewinder and stay a while. You can check out anytime you'd like, but you can never leave. Just kidding. Thank you in advance for supporting the show, and I can't wait to see you over there.